Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the programs here at WFYI, all the podcasts here at WFYI, they're available on Spotify. Well, friends, we survived another week and another snow-ridden week. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. And hopefully you got to watch some films that were new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we'll get to the grab-a-pencil portion of the show a little later on. But I want to go through what I watched this week. And one of the films I watched is a reason for me to dip into the archive. So hopefully have a nice epic of film sociology here to keep you warm this weekend. I'm really excited that I was kind of perplexed that they delayed the opening of this film, but I know it is, I believe, still going to be qualified for Oscar contention this year because it was released before the end of the calendar year, regardless if it was in theaters or not. Streaming has become more acceptable. But I'm really excited that finally opening in theaters and streaming at the same time is my number one film of 2020, as well as the IFJA pick for best film of the year. And that's Chloe Zhao's Nomadland, starring Frances McDormand as a woman who lives out of her van and travels throughout the American West from job to job, season to season, task to task. And Chloe Zhao's previous film that really struck with me hard in a good way was the film The Rider, which I remember saying was a kind of a bull riding version of The Wrestler. And that film had all non-actors. and the performances she's able to get out of them, very natural, very to the point, and gorgeous footage of the American plains. And that is similar in this, except you have two recognizable faces with Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, two of the old players from the 80s. But it's also interesting that I've been watching some of the 50s and 60s films of Federico Fellini and watching his early neorealism. And there is a neorealism work to The Rider, and especially with Nomadland. But in this case, you have two actors who are able to bounce off everybody on screen beautifully. And McDormand's character says she is not homeless, just houseless, living out of her van and getting seasonal work everywhere from working at a park to Amazon. And it's a fascinating look at this life. And the other people, she was able to meet other nomads like her. And I don't recall knowing about this form of existence. It makes sense. And the thing that really resonated, besides it being a beautifully understated, quiet, powerful film, but this is the group of people I thought of more than anything else cinematically on how COVID would affect them. And it became twice as strong for me to revisit this film. And when you get emotions shaken out of you from a film, that's mission accomplished. And Nomadland did that more than any other film in 2020. And I'm really, really excited that it's finally out. So please do not miss Nomadland. If you're comfortable seeing it in the theater, go for it. But it's just as strong streaming as it is on a big screen. So beautiful little story, no matter the size of the screen. But not your phones. I'm still not ready to watch a movie on a phone. And I got a new phone recently, but I just can't do it. So, all right. So that's the big title. I'm very, very excited about that. And I'll get to some video releases on next week's program. But I was able to revisit, because I actually bought it, and I apologize for buying it so late, James Keach. But the documentary Glen Campbell, I'll Be Me, that James Keach, who was a guest on the show back in 2015, that's the interview I'm going to replay in a bit. But it's about Glen Campbell's final tour, and he has been hit with Alzheimer's, and it's a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute struggle, where there are moments on stage that is just spot on and other days where it's just not happening. And it's heartbreaking to watch. And with the recent death of a friend, of a relative in my household, it really hits home. And so anyway, if you've not seen I'll Be Me, go check that out. Monday and Tuesday were snow days, at least in our house. I'm sure it was for many of you. And I was, my other work, my non-radio work, I had snow days again at age 51. Those were the perfect days to experience Fellini's La Dolce Vita and 8 and a half, because I wasn't going anywhere and you got plenty of time. And these are two of his big masterpieces, especially 8 and a half. La Dolce Vita is an episodic affair of a journalist, kind of a gossip journalist played by Marcello Mastroianni. And we wish all journalists looked like Marcello Mastroianni in the 50s. And the various women that come in and out of his life. That is also tackled in 8 and a half, where it's the Marcello plays, not Fellini, oh no, maybe, but plays a filmmaker, and he's mounting his next project, and he has no idea what to make of it. And yes, and if you're a fan of musical theater, if you're a fan of Nine, and you should really watch 8 and a half if you've not done that. But first, you got to watch Knights of Cabiria, and then if you're a fan of Sweet Charity. But great looking films, and they take their time. I mean, La Dolce Vita is almost 3 hours long. 8 and a half is about 2:20, and you just got to roll with it. And this was him getting out of his neorealism films of the 50s, and it's been a while since I've watched his later work in the 70s, which I know was very, very visual and probably a little more cynical, I think. So I can't wait to check that out. But I'm now halfway through the Fellini box set that Criterion put out. So I think I'm doing pretty good time, at least faster time than the Bergman collection. No disrespect to Ingmar Bergman. But yeah, so those are definitely worth checking out. And because of last week's show, because Michael Doucet of Beau Soleil, who is a wonderful guest, and I now have a show I have an interview that I'm going to replay every Mardi Gras weekend here at Film Sociology. One of the films, if you did not hear last week's conversation, he goes off on The Big Easy, which originally was supposed to be set in Chicago, and then they moved it down to New Orleans. So that was cool. And I read a few posts online on my Facebook page saying a couple folks said this is the film that made them fall in love with New Orleans, or fall in love with Dennis Quaid, or fall in love with Ellen Barkin. But Michael went off on the Cajun accent of Dennis Quaid, saying, "Oh, he doesn't sound like a Cajun. He sounds like he's from Texas." And I have a friend that really likes his Cajun accent. I think it's also the man behind the voice as well. But so anyway, I revisited it, and I still enjoy it. He is a Quaid plays a generational cop in New Orleans, investigating a murder. And then the assistant district attorney, played by Ellen Barkin, both of them in this film, 1986, are probably at their cinematic sexiness apex. And she comes in as far as investigating police corruption, which could include the likes of Quaid's father figure, authority figure, played by Ned Beatty, and a younger John Goodman is in this film as well. And it's kind of standard cop film, but really nice energy between Quaid and Barkin, and a great soundtrack. And it was funny because Michael Doucet went off on the Cajun accent of Dennis Quaid, and I sort of dismisses the film, but Beau Soleil has a song on the soundtrack. So he's having his cake and eating it too. his new Mardi Gras cake, of being able to go off on the film and still get royalty checks for it. So I love Michael Doucet. He's fun, fun, fun. But yeah, it was fun to watch The Big Easy again. There's, you know, some of the 80s cop tropes that maybe haven't aged well as far as grabbing a woman's hair by the back of the head when smooching is probably now a questionable move in 2021. And a lot of 80s lighting, although it's involving scenes with Alan Barkin and Dennis Quaid doing things. So he kind of let that slide, I guess. But it was fun to revisit for me. And and then finally, last night, Mrs. Sosi, my wife Lynn, plopped down with me on the couch, and she had never seen Claudine. And I thought that might be more fun for her to watch instead of the special features of 8 and a Half. So, you know, wonderful performances from Diane Carroll, who received an Oscar nomination for that, as well as James Earl Jones. And yes, we all wish all garbage men look like James Earl Jones and all maids look like Diane Carroll. But I talked about this film last year when it came out on Criterion, and I remember always liking the performances, and I'm liking the film more and more. Just her trying to maintain a relationship with a new man, as well as six kids, and dealing with work and welfare and the lives that especially the older kids have in her household. So wonderful work. And of course, a great soundtrack written and produced by Curtis Mayfield and music sung by Gladys Knight and the Pips. So that's what I watched this week. So, you know, very good week, if I do say so myself. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. And because I brought up Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, is a good excuse to dip into the archives for my 2015 interview with James Keach, actor, writer, director. Yes, Stacey's brother, but he's a man in his own right. And it's actually almost, we're kind of past the anniversary. This was on February 2nd of 2015. I don't remember how I got the interview, but I got notice that he was going to be in town. And I kind of jumped at the chance. He was in town trying to get financing from Eli Lilly to help finance to promote the film. And one of the deals was I could do the interview, but I had to pick him up from his hotel, which I was happy to do. I just remember it was blistering cold. And he had a meeting that morning. So I remember having to drive into town very early, pick him up at his hotel at, if I remember, like 8 a.m., bring him here, do the interview, and then drive him back in time. And it worked out. It worked out well. And anyway, that's the fun film sociology adventure behind the scenes. But now we go to my 2015 interview with I'll Be Me director James Keach. Enjoy. So, James, why are you in Indianapolis besides promoting the film?
Indianapolis. We're in Indianapolis promoting the film to meet with Eli Lilly about potential sponsorship for the film throughout the world.
I'm really glad you made the film. It's really well done. Really enjoyed it, and it gives a warts and all look of what Glenn has had to go through. When did you start filming, and how long did it take?
We started filming in the summer of 2011, thinking it was going to be a 5.5 week tour, it turned out to be in a 2.5 year shoot, 151 shows. The reason being is when Glenn first came out and said that he had Alzheimer's and that he was going to go out and tour, he had very few bookings, and I think most people were very fearful that this was going to be a train wreck. And as soon as the audiences saw it, they realized that this was one of the most inspiring things that anybody had ever seen. And the bookings just continued to grow, and so did the reviews. The reviews were very, very positive. And so that's how it ended to be 2.5 years. So I should say that we thought that we would be only doing it for 5.5 weeks, and we're kind of relieved at the thought of doing it because we couldn't figure out a way to make a show that was going to be uplifting and positive about a guy with Alzheimer's. The producer of his last two albums was a very good friend of mine, and he kept saying, "Come on, James. You've been shooting rock shows for a while. You have all the equipment. Come on, just do it. Just record it for history." Well, we did record it for history, but it also, in doing that changed our life, changed my life personally, completely, actually. As a filmmaker and as a guy who was very, very much afraid of what Alzheimer's is and what it might do to somebody, too, being an advocate for really wanting to change the conversation about it and to really inform the world as to what we're up against and to let people see what a hero Glenn Campbell is.
Now, you said the producer, record producer, was that how you got involved with the project?
Julian Raymond. Mm-hmm. Julian Raymond who produced Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, and Ghost on a Canvas. Was producing my son Johnny, who was 13 at the time, was producing his music and kept coming into the studio and saying, "Come on, man, you got to meet Glenn." Because I'd made a movie a few years before called Walk the Line.
Yep.
And produced it, and he said, "You know, we got to do something about Glenn before it's too late." And I didn't know what too late was in the early parts of our conversation. Too late, of course, turned out to be Alzheimer's. And I said to Julian and my partner Trevor Albert, we both said to him, "Look, we made that movie. We did the biopic, and it's not that Glenn's not an incredible story. It's just that you kind of want to try and work on other kinds of pictures, you know. And you got to meet him. This went on for 6 months. Finally, he said, he's going to tell the world he's got Alzheimer's. He's going to do a very short tour. Will you meet him, please?" So we said, "Sure, we'll meet him." And Glenn, when he came over, by the way, over the weekend beforehand, we watched everything we could about Alzheimer's. And everything we saw was so, so depressing. It always showed people at the end stages of it, or the scientific version of it. Except in The Notebook, which was a beautiful, beautiful film, I thought. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. There weren't documentaries that showed it. And then we met Glenn. Glenn comes into the house, and he's with his beautiful wife Kim, and Johnny's walking across the living room, and has his guitar in his hand, and he goes, "Hey, I play guitar." And Johnny goes, "Yes, sir, I know you play guitar." He says, "You want me to show you something?" And Johnny says, "Sure." And he picks up the guitar and he just shreds it. And he said, "That's what Uncle Boo taught me. You practice that, you'll be good." And then Johnny walked into his bedroom and took his guitar, and Glenn looked at Kim, and he said, "You know what? A man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. I found me a good thing. That's my thing." And he's talking to Kim, and she said, and then Kim said to me, "James, you know, Glenn's got Alzheimer's, and we want you to film this." And he says, "What? I got what?" He said, "You got Alzheimer's." He says, "No, I don't. I got part-timers." So you got it right up front. Here was the guy who's in love with his wife, who's an incredible musician, who wasn't afraid to talk about what was going on in his life. Oh, and here comes Johnny walking back across the living room. And Glenn looks over at him and says, "Hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something?" So we got to see the whole thing right there, like in a period of 5 minutes.
A natural pitch.
And it was just like, wow, this guy is so, he's funny, he's self-deprecating, he's engaging, he's, and that's what he is in the film. And so just felt that, 5 weeks, that's what Kim says, it's only 5 weeks, it's going to be 5 weeks, okay. And so here we are 4 years later, I'm still talking about it. And the film is just now beginning to begin its journey out into the world. That we were in 80 cities and did probably, I don't know, it's the best reviewed film I've ever made. And if you could imagine the song in the movie called "I'm Not Gonna Miss You," and it's the last song, was nominated for an Academy Award. Now, if you can imagine a guy 76 years old with Alzheimer's nominated for an Academy Award, and 3 Grammys, and the broadcast critics thing, and I mean, it's just like, who would have ever thought? That's not why we got into it. What I'm saying is that when Glenn Campbell said, "I ain't done yet," and he was told to hang up his guitar, and here's a guy that we all, given some terrible diagnosis of whatever, Alzheimer's, cancer, heart disease, whatever, a lot of us just go, "Okay, poor me," and go sit on the pity pot, and that's the end of it. Instead, he said, nope, I'm going to keep playing until I can't play anymore. And in so doing, what he's doing is he's shown the world a way to, the Alzheimer's, he's shown the world a way to live, and his family, the caregiving. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful tribute to a family. And for me, as a film, I don't know.
You got it.
Yeah, I and I got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, which is 1,400 hours of film, I got to do it. Yeah.
So you had not met him before this?
No, I didn't. I had not. And they knew of me because of John Cash, and they knew people, obviously, that knew John Cash, and John Cash was a dear friend of my wife's and mine, and was the godfather of my kids, and he asked me to make that movie, so...
Well, I'd say the amount of footage, and I know you said you shot 1,400, but the amount of footage, warts and all, ups and downs. I wondered if you had known him, because the amount of the access that you were able to get, you know, backstage at home. So the fact that you didn't, I mean, I think that's something to be said about you as a filmmaker, as well as capturing it with the camera.
Well. You know, I think it is something to be said about me as a filmmaker, maybe as a person. I love to talk to people. I like asking questions more than I like talking about, you know, myself. I like sharing stories of people's lives. I'm very interested in where people come from. And Glenn and I and John Cash, we all shared one similar thing. And that is, I didn't have to. All my friends when I was growing up, a little small town in Texas, they picked cotton because that's what they had to do. And I picked cotton because they did, and I wanted to go do it. So I always knew where they came from, these guys, you know, from the cotton fields and struggles with substances there was always an honesty about our conversations, and I think when I said to the family, I said, "Look, I'm not going to put anything in this film that I wouldn't say about my own dad." And you know, after a period of time, at first people were reluctant. All the people on the crew, they'd look at you and they go, "Who is this guy?" And then, you know, you spend enough time with somebody and you get to know their character, and that's the interesting thing about. For me, going from narrative film to documentary film is that in narrative film, you write the script. And, of course, the actors, when they're really – the performances are great. They trust you like the families do in the documentaries. They start trusting when you see something nuanced that, you know, you say, you know, that's really good, but maybe let's try it a little different. And they trust that you're not trying to manipulate them into something that you want to see. If you're really good, they're trusting that you want to – bring the best out in them, which is a big difference, mm-hmm. You know. And I think the Campbells, they wanted to tell the true story, but they also, dignity was something very important. And I was there to help take care of Glenn. Trevor and I, we became part of the caregiving group. We would take Glenn when you know, he was having a problem or he was lost somewhere, we'd go find him, and you know, we were there all the time. So it became a very different experience, and that's what I mean, because I've become an advocate. I now understand what caregiving is about, mm-hmm. and the role of the caregiver, and how this is just, it's so important that people understand this. And we did a screening in Nashville for 4,000 people at one time, and then we did a concert afterwards, and I was the MC of the show, and the band Perry was playing, and Ashley Campbell and Delta Ray. There was the three bands that were playing after the screening. And I, to cover the time of setting up, I said to the audience, how many people in this audience, I'm just curious, how many people have been touched by Alzheimer's or caregiving or somebody who knows? And 4,000 people stood up. And I went, and how many of you actually talk to other people about it? And almost all of them sat down. Because there's a whole shame connected with it. There's a whole, you know, embarrassment. There's the, you know, and that's what Glenn's doing. By he's showing us, you don't have to hide. We don't have to, we can understand. We can have compassion for people who have this. And one of the things that was so moving and important to me in as a human being in making the film and really reinforced my faith in humanity was that the audience, when he would play, instead of being judgmental and when he would forget a line or something like that, they cheered him on.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him standing ovation after standing ovation for his courage. And I will say that in between, you know, when he messed something up and then he'd get it back, and when he'd get it back, he'd get it back in spades. He'd just kill it. I mean, he's still a genius musician. But it was still that spirit of and that's why it was, seeing the show was so cool, because it was like an experience. It was you don't know what's going to happen next. It's like a movie where you sit on the edge of your seat and you don't know what's going to happen. Is the teleprompter going to break down? Mm-hmm. Or is he going to play in the wrong key, which he did some nights? And the kids they learned how to really be good musicians, because he would play, he'd start in the wrong key and he would not come out of it. And so now they had to switch.
They had to adjust.
Exactly. So.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because you know, Glenn did a show in Carmel, which is just north of here, and I think it was a couple of weeks before it became known, before he went public with Alzheimer's. And, of course, the reviews were saying that the performance was erratic and, you know, he'd start, he'd repeat. So, you know, obviously a couple of weeks later, we finally got the explanation as to why. But, yeah, you said, watching the show, because I remember this, I think there's a part where his wife says, you know, here's your teleprompter, here's your mark. And as an audience member, when you would see him veer right or veer left, you kind of tense up a little bit and like, oh, I hope he's all right. Hope he makes it. And you were able to show sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't.
Right. That makes for good drama, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's right. That's one of the things that was so exciting about it. And I was always on stage right. I had his close-up camera. So that was the other thing about, you know, going from there. Usually, you know, you have Conrad Hall shooting the movie when you're making, you know, something like that. Instead, it's James Keach, and the other guys were all shooting cameras, and it was really exciting, you know. And one night, Glenn at Carnegie Hall, he walked over to me, and he walked right into this giant close up, and he goes, "Hey, like a rhinestone cowboy," and he puts the mic right in my mouth. And he wants me to sing it with me, and I said, "Stop it, stop that!" You know, and I had to do it. I did it in the audience chair. But it was fun.
I was wondering, you mentioned how often did he notice the camera whether it was in studio or at home?
He would notice it sometimes. He liked it. You know, he's one of those guys. It's probably like you with that microphone. You like having it in front of you. You feel good because this is your world.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn's world was being on that stage, and he liked, he wanted to make the movie. He wanted us to be around. And he'd forget it. He'd forget that we were there. When one of the most moving moments for me filming was at the Mayo Clinic, and they would only allow one camera in. And that was me, mm-hmm. And they're injecting him with dye to do a PET scan of his brain, and he's there, and he wondered where I was right at the beginning, and then he forgot I was even there, because I set up two cameras and I let one roll for a wide shot over here, and I had a close up camera straight on him, and I was pretty far back, because I like to use longer lenses. I didn't ever want to get too close to him, because I didn't want him to be conscious of me being there. And he just starts singing to Kim, and they go into their own world. And he trusted me as a person, so he always knew that if I was in the room, everything was okay. Somehow that if I was nearby, that he kept him calm. So the camera became a friend to him, his friend.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he noticed the camera. He never played to it. He certainly never, ever did things for the camera for performance.
And I also wondered if depending on what day he had, of him wondering, what are these people doing in my house because of the Alzheimer's? That never happened?
Well, a lot of times what we would do with the cameras there is we would set them up and we'd walk away.
Okay.
Yeah, or Kim would set him up and walk away, you know, and it was just there. And then we would go through the footage.
You mentioned how funny he is, and I think a lot of people forget that. I mean, the guy had a variety show at one time, so we know the musicality. But, yeah, seeing him working with his family, especially with his family on the road, and, yeah, even talking with doctors, he's just a sunlight.
He is. He you know, he said it in the film, I've laughed and I've cried. It's a hell of a lot better to laugh. And he loved Roger Miller, and he would always tell jokes. He always wanted you to smile, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he still does like people. You go visit with Glenn now, and you don't know what he's laughing about, but he's laughing about something, and he starts laughing so hard that he gets everybody else laughing. You know, he's just an amazing, special, honest guy. That's the other thing that he would say things in his Alzheimer's repetitiveness that were very important to him. Like when a man findeth a good woman, talk about Kim. He has very deep belief, very deep faith. And he would also always talk about the importance of telling the truth. You know, and how lying's no good. And then he would talk about drugs. And if there was ever an anti-drug guy, it was him, about how it really messed his life up for a short period of time. But that short period of time, you know, was magnified into a real media thing. And I think the alcohol thing was, I think the alcohol was to self-medicate his, the beginnings of his Alzheimer's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all this stuff, all the drugs and substance abuse and everything, it's to deal with the pain that comes from so far back in all our lives, you know, and we're trying to self-medicate the pain, I think. That's just my opinion. You know, when Glenn would talk about his growing up and how tough it was where he came from, and the same thing with John Cash. It was tough, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure through many, many people in this country, it's really tough.
Now, not really giving away anything, but we do get to see the final concert, and I know the tour was hit. I mean, they ended the tour on the right note. I guess it was
Napa,
right? And I guess it was best to finish it here, and get out while the getting is good, I guess. Was that your original intent, or was that their original intent? It was just covering the tour, and then that's it.
The original intent, first of all, the original intent was 5.5 weeks.
Right, yes.
So 2.5 years later, you know, millions of dollars later, oh my gosh, you know, and maybe someday we'll get it back. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the world see the film. And I think for your audience that I can promise them that they will be uplifted, and it's funny. There's more big laughs in this movie than there are in major comedies. I mean, it's funny. He is so funny. Your question is, was that the intent to end it here? That was the last book show of that year. And we all felt that Glenn wasn't enjoying it as much. It was agitating him.
Mm.
And yet the night before that show might have been his best show. Which is, that's the thing that's so amazing about this thing. And he was still good that night. He's still, you know, Southern Nights, the song he ends with is beautiful. And it's just that, you know, he wasn't enjoying it as much, and it was getting him agitated and stressed out and disoriented. So the whole idea was not to do the show because we had to do the show, because there was a need to make money or anything. It was to prolong Glenn's health. That's ultimately the idea, is to give him the opportunity to do what he loves the most. Because we believe, and I think the doctors that have seen the film since subsequently, that this really prolonged his journey as a musician and as a human being, because soon after we stopped, even though the last song was done several months later, I filmed that several months later with the Wrecking Crew. He went downhill pretty fast after this, after the tour was over. I mean, we'd go and play little clubs here and there. We'd bring musicians over. One night we went to see Merle Haggard and Toby Keith was there, and we went out into the bus and played, which is really cool. and he could still just kill it, you know. But, you know, it's, I don't know. Alzheimer's is a tricky thing, man. It's it breaks your heart. It breaks your heart when you, it breaks the hearts of the people that are around the people more than it breaks the hearts of the people that are suffering from it. At least in the end stages. Mm-hmm. In the beginning stages, when you know you have it and you're getting and you're facing it, you know, it's not easy.
Well, and shifting gears a little bit, congratulations on the film getting a nomination for the song. I know it's, will you be at the Oscars?
I hope so. Yeah, I will. I will. I'm a member of the Academy, so I'll be there. But it got nominated for 3 Grammys too.
Yes, congrats on that as well.
Which I just think is, you know, you got nominated for Best Video. For the Country Music Association. So, you know, I am not a spring chicken. So, and this was my first music video. So, it's never too late. It's never too late. You can go out there and make your music video. I tell you that now.
Well, I'm not going to ask your age, but I do love directors with a 6, a 7, and an 8 in their age still making work. Still, I mean, I play jazz and blues musicians that are in their 90s still putting out product, still putting out work.
It's good, man.
Absolutely.
Hey, man. You know, I mean, listen. Look at Clint. I did a movie with Clint with Robert Duvall.
Stars Fall on Henrietta.
Yeah, right. And I'll never forget Clint's. I said, "Do you have one note for me, Clint?" He said, "Yeah. If you got the shot, move the camera." Meaning, don't do the same take twice, which is really interesting because he's so sparse, you know, in what he does. And here. And here's the absurdity of the Academy. Here's a guy. This is maybe his best film in many, many, many years, and he's not nominated. You know, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, there's such politics in all these organizations. You know, if you're not a member of the Doc Branch, you're not a member of the Little Club. You know, you're a member of the Narrative Branch. You know, it's if you're not a member of the Narrative Branch. You know, and you're a member of the Doc Branch. It's just, you know, it's human nature. You know, we're all in our little cliques, and you know, but Clint's work is remarkable.
Two films in 1 year.
Yeah, and one of which I did not care for at all, and I wondered what the heck did you do that for? You know, and although there was some good stuff in it, but I guess he did it because he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that he loved that period of music because he loves music.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't a bad film. I mean, well, I like the play better. How's that?
Sure. That's all right.
I enjoyed the play more. But, you know, for those people who never knew who those guys were, the Jersey Boys, and the kids that are growing up, your kids, my kids.
It's a good 101.
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing for them to see, and it'll live, and it'll be fine. So. But that, compared to American Sniper, my God.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's been able to, I mean, you know, he retired the tough guy. He retired his Western persona with Unforgiven. He retired his tough guy persona with Gran Torino. And he's been able to direct anything he wants, whether it's Jersey Boys or American Sniper or Bridges in Madison County or Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, to be able to direct what you want and have a studio backing you on that, that's rare.
Yeah, you got to be named Clint Eastwood.
Now, you said you'd filmed concert footage before. Who else have you shot?
I went out with Cheap Trick.
Yeah?
Yeah, Johnny, the kid opened for Cheap Trick for 2 years. So that's what we were doing.
Cool.
It was fun.
So between your film and Still Alice, there is a lot, you know, people are talking more about Alzheimer's. I've even approached by a lot of people, whether it's on the street or at festivals. You know, you mentioned the Nashville event. Has that become almost a daily occurrence now?
We have requests for around 300 screenings. And it's just going to grow exponentially, I think. And You know, we were reading yesterday in China, the number is staggering, how many people have it. So I think the long tail of this movie is going to be great. And I think, too, that the thing that's exceptional about it is that there's music in it. It makes it so palpable because, you know, you get to see a guy play his music, and it's good music. And the Still Alice movie and Julianne Moore's performance is really good. There's no question about it. There's not a lot of laughs, and it's a narrative linear progression from you got it to you're out of it, and Glenn is the difference. Of course, is one is real and one is imagined, mm-hmm. and I think. We screened it here, actually, at Lilly a few weeks ago, and the head of their Japanese global marketing division saw it, and she wants to take it to Japan, and so take it to Australia, and it's a huge problem in China. And the thing that's cool about it is that it's a very entertaining film. So if you can entertain people, inform them, empower them, inspire them, get them to want to make a change, we got a shot at slowing this sucker down because we need everybody to, we need financial support to do it, you know, and I think that most people have perceived this as being an old person's thing, and it's not. The people that are going to suffer the most from it are the young people because they're going to have to take care of the old people. It's going to break the economy, which is a frightening thing, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, just to talk realistically, 2050 it'll exceed the national. 2025 it'll exceed the national defense budget. 2050 you'll start breaking the economy.
Mm-hmm. You said it took 2.5 years. What did you do in between? I mean, did you have pockets of time where you were able to work on other projects, or were
not
you just
really.
Kind of on standby?
No, not really. This has been my life for a while.
Well, it's not just Steve James who has the multi-year commitments when it comes to making documentaries. You're now a part of that club. So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
If I may, I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to personally thank you for creating The Long Riders.
Ah, good.
I got to see that with my dad when it came out. Where did that start? Where did telling the story of the James family come about for you?
My brother and I did a movie called Orville and Wilbur.
Yep.
We played the Wright brothers. And so we thought, let's play the wrong brothers. So Stacy and I, you know, he at the time, he's 7 years older, and at the time he was just starting to really ascend as a movie star. And I went off and I was into music, and I said, we'll try and write it as a country western musical. We did it as the Bandit Kings, and so we made a musical about the James Gang. I just thought it would be cool because it was the time Keith was doing Hair and Keith Carradine, and, mm-hmm. and you know there was a lot of musicals being done, and Godspell, and it was a cool time in the theater in New York, and so we started to do that, and then
I'm sorry, but when he says the James Gang, he doesn't mean the group with Joe Walsh. That's another group.
Yeah, this is the Jesse James
the
Gang.
The actual Jesse James Gang.
Jesse James, Cole Younger, you know, the Miller Brothers, yeah. So we did it for a while, and we played it at the Bowery Lane Theater, and it was fun. And then we said, let's try and develop it into a movie. So we took the script and wrote the script, and then I was doing a film in Bora Bora with Tim Zinnemann. And Tim Zinnemann had done a movie with Walter Hill, and he said, what are you working on all the time? And I said, I'm working on this. And he said, let me read it. And he said, you know who'd like this is Walter Hill. And so he said, can you get all those guys? And I said, I don't know. Yeah, I think we can. So Keith was doing an album, and so we went to the record plant. It's burned down now. The record plant. In Hollywood, and we got the Bridges brothers, the Carradine brothers, the Keats brothers, and we all went out into the alley. It was like 2 a.m, and we took a picture of all of us together, and we sent it to them, and that began the journey. The Bridges brothers eventually weren't able to do it, and it became the Guest brothers, Chris and Nick Guest. And the, oh, and the Quaids.
Quaids.
And the Quaids were in the picture, too. Randy and Dennis Quaid. So, yeah, so that original script, we wrote the original script, and Walter came in and did a rewrite on the script. We did a rewrite on that script, and then we went and we made it, and it was awesome.
Where'd you shoot it?
We shot it in Clayton, Georgia, Albany, Georgia, Texas, and Sonora, California, where they had the trains. We did single gauge trains.
Besides the brothers casting, which I think is a great marketing tool, not a gimmick, but I also read that Walter Hill and wanted to have a family feel on the film, and obviously that paid off not only with your brothers, but the film also humanizes these characters that we kind of grew up knowing as being notorious bad guys, and then seeing them at home chopping wood, dealing with the women in their lives. You know, that seemed more interesting than just black hats versus white hats.
Well, that's what it was. You know, it was like, you know, when Jesse's mother was and his brother was tortured, and they were, you know, you understood why they did what they did. You know, why they were so upset about everything, and why, you know, they went after the Pinkertons. One of the things about wars that we don't understand is we see all the people running down the streets. You know, the Iranians, the Iraqis. We don't have compassion for the fact that they, you know, those kids are born and they're nurtured and they're loved and they're, you know, we dehumanize them in some way, and which is sad. And in this case, the James gang, this was a family, and they were wronged. In my opinion, they were wronged by the North. They were, you know, and they took it upon themselves, rightly or wrongly, to seek revenge for it, you know.
Now, how was it working with Walter Hill as a director, and did he later influence you as a director?
I love Walter. Walter, here's Walter. I love telling the story. I can tell it now, years later. So we're out in front of a Corkindale barn, and there's a big shootout. And on the, you know, in those days, they probably still do. The barn, they would squib the barn. They put squibs, they put M13s or whatever things in the barn. And they would blow holes in it to appear as if bullet holes were coming through, so that you get, and then they'd backlight it so that the light would come flashing through and you'd see all these holes in the barn. So I'm out there with a rifle and I'm shooting in front of the barn, and we're, there's this whole thing going on, you know, big raid, and about three of these M13s blow up, and they hit me in the back, and it blows holes literally in my back, you know, and blood, and my knees buckle, because I'm just it's not like I can't hold myself up. I've been hit, and I'm going down on the ground, and I'm shooting. It's in slow motion, and it's cool, and I hear Walter go, God, Keith, damn it. If you ever do that again, I'll bullwhip you. What are you talking about? They're carrying me off to the hospital. Said, you can't fall down like that. You're Jesse James. Walter, you know, I had stitches in my back and everything. He was funny. He always appeared to be a tough guy. He was John Ford's second assistant director. So, you know, and John
he survived Peckinpah as well.
Right, he survived Peckinpah, and he liked to wear the eye patch and all that stuff, you know. And but he's a terrific filmmaker and a good guy. And, you know, he liked making those tough guy movies. He was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also makes me want to have Ry Cooter provide the soundtrack of my life.
Ry Cooter's pretty darn good.
Pretty good.
Pretty darn
not
good.
Bad at all.
Not bad at all.
So, as you said, you're 7 years younger than Stacey. What's it like to direct your brother?
Well, now he asks me to direct him in lots of movies. For many years, he was like, hey, kid, you know. So now I think he figures I've proved myself as a filmmaker. But it's actually his... He was directing. The reason I wanted to become a director was because of him. He was doing a movie, down in Alabama, about an Alabama prison, And he was doing a little documentary, and I came into the editing room, and I would watch him cut it, and it was just so fascinating to me how films were put together. I loved it. So I really fell in love with the whole idea of it, and I still am in love with it. It's still magic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still 90 minutes in the dark is magic. Going to the movies and making movies is it's the coolest thing you can do.
What are you working on next?
You know, it's interesting. We've developed a lot of narrative scripts, but I am leaning towards making documentaries. During the period of this film, because of the caregiver and all the stuff that caregivers go through, we started talking to people who've been connected with the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's fascinating to talk to them about the moral injury that takes place when you have to do things like in war that you shouldn't do, that it goes against your conscience, and caregiving, and when you're dealing with people with health, the problems that you have. So there's something very interesting to me about that moral injury thing that takes place in all of us that causes addiction, that causes pain, that causes. So I'm kind of intrigued to look at that area and to try and find, to make a movie kind of like Glenn's movie that's inspirational, but that will allow people to see and to have empathy for people who have to, like soldiers who do things like this and what they go through and how we can help them, and people who are caregivers, how we can help them and how we can help ourselves, heal ourselves. So I suppose that's something that's an area that I'm interested in. And I don't know. I think there's a lot to be said about it, and I think there's not a lot said about it.
And now that you have a title of director of an Academy Award nominated documentary, that will hopefully get a little more incentive.
I don't know. I hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
James Keach, the director of the documentary Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. If you've not seen that, you really should. Add that to your collection. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching over the past week. And we start, as usual, online by my buddy Eric, his first time viewing of the documentary Framing Britney Spears, which he's dubbed as Good Plus. I haven't gotten to that yet. In his rewatch, he's still going through the Hitchcock films, 1959's North by Northwest, which he deemed peerless. And then also for him, the landmark 90s comedy Groundhog Day from 1993. So thank you, Eric. Appreciate that. Over on Twitter, Megan writes, Dead Poets Society popped up last night, and I couldn't resist. Nothing wrong with that, Megan. At DaddyPants1220, hey, AJ Reed, finishing up Little Big Man this morning. Found out it was released the week I was born in 1970. You know, that's a good idea for a show of what films opened the weekend or the week that you were born. I like that. I might have to actually, that might be a show. Roger writes, The Dig on Netflix, Like a Boss, and then put in parentheses, Wife's Choice. And then hope to get to Judas and the Black Messiah this weekend. Very good. Coors Light Pappy writes, Mean Streets, No Country for Old Men, All the President's Men, Call Me by Your Name, and Casablanca. Strong there. Laura asks, any movie? And I said yes. Lou Harry writes, Judas and the Black Messiah, Giant, T for Two, My Dream is Yours, The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, and Shin Godzilla. And then writes in parentheses, how's that for a mix? It's a mix. One could even say it's a curious mix. Sky point to Jill. Laura again comes back, Wedding Crashers, and I'm more excited than I should be about a potential sequel. Okay. Kevin writes, The 36th Chamber of Shaolin. I'm sorry about that. Creighton writes, I've watched the amazing and hugely underrated 2002 horror flick May, and Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Nick Rogers writes, May and Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Now that's a picture. Yes, indeed. And he added both titles on purpose. Clayton or Claytone writes, I introduced my wife to Behind the Candelabra and Mother. She very much enjoyed one over the other. You're free to guess which one. Man, Claytone, I hope that wasn't a double feature. Lisa 46 writes, three of the Narnia movies and Moonrise Kingdom, all with my high schooler. All right, very good. Yes, my college girl, my college freshman, loves the films of Wes Anderson. So that's over on Twitter. We go to Facebook, and Austin Glidden, happy birthday, Austin. Go check out his Medium Cool podcast. Whether I'm a guest on it or not, it's worth listening. But he writes Land, Judas and the Black Messiah, and Willy's Wonderland. Cheryl writes, rewatch Taxi Driver, since there was a couple podcasts about it I listened to, and man, it is a masterpiece. I agree, Cheryl, and I'm just with you on that. Rosalie writes, The Dig. Judith writes, White Tiger was an amazing glimpse inside the caste system in India. Hard to watch, but very interesting. Bill writes, One Night in Miami. Jan writes, Digging Deep into the Library, Galaxy Quest. What a gem. And what a savings. Barbara Hobbs. Barbara writes, It's Complicated, John Wick, and Catch Me If You Can. And that's a title, not a command. Right, Barbara? Missy writes, Finish the Stand. It was horrible. But she finished it. Mario writes, From Russia with Love. Emily writes, Oh, the Cinderella with Brandy. That's been popping up quite a bit. I think that just became available on Disney Plus. Bedknobs and Broomsticks and the original Star Wars trilogy. Tommy writes, Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick. That's right, Mr. Lohman. There you go. Teresa writes, Get Out, The Help, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, The Intern, and The Shape of Water. Keith writes, The Hero. That's the Sam Elliott film. Rosanna writes, The documentary P.S. Burn This Letter. Aggie writes, The Day After Tomorrow. Missy comes back in. Been binge-watching Ozark, Bloodline, finished the series Waiting for God, and started The Sinner and Mrs. Brown's Boys. Thank you, Missy. Doug writes, The Road to Utopia, 1946, Guys and Dolls, 1955, and A Most Beautiful Thing, 2020. Gretchen writes, Started The Stranger and Can't Stop Watching It. John writes, The Sound of Music and Knights of Cabiria with a thank you to me. Thank you, John. See, I love these moments when it's something that you watch because I talked about it or vice versa, and that does happen. So thank you, John. Robert writes, Malcolm and Marie. Jessica writes, Freaky, decent, and Greenland. Surprise, it's really good. Mark writes, American Sniper. Monica Hartz writes, We watch Super Troopers, Meryl. Black Panther, Meryl. Infinity War, Captain Marvel, and Endgame. And Meryl. Spencer writes, With the passing of Limbaugh, I will be rewatching A Face in the Crowd tonight on HBO Max. And it's a great Criterion Blu-ray if you have that as well. Abby writes, Judas and the Black Messiah, and now watching The Adventures of Merlin. Jason writes, East Side Sushi on Netflix. Courtney writes, The Right Stuff. Kiera writes, Jojo Rabbit. Scott also chimes in with, I love that movie. It was amazing. Joshua writes, Framing Britney Spears, The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, The Prestige, Judas and the Black Messiah, The Lady and the Dale, The Mustang, and Harriet. Daniel writes, Coming to America, Madam X, By Love Possessed, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Bundle of Joy, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Gun Crazy, Gods and Monsters, Opening Night, The Woman in the Window, Laura Lansing Slept Here. Daniel, I love your eclectic mix there, friend. David writes, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Taylor writes, Jupiter Ascending, The Old Guard, Angels and Demons, The Lady Vanishes, Castle Fu Manchu, Gonzo, Isle of Fury, Captain Marvel, Birds of Prey, and the fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. And Argo. Thank you, Taylor. Janet writes, Dark Waters, Black Rain, The Iron Lady, and Heartbreakers. Michelle writes, Still watching The Man in the High Castle. Carrie writes, The Best Man, the one with Will Ferrell and Ice Skate. That's Blades of Glory. So funny. Craig writes, No movies, but binging Spiral and that's how it's known in France, so I'm not going to butcher it in French. Craig's been watching Spiral. Thank you, Craig. Adrian writes Sicario. It was really good. Chris Lloyd writes Blythe Spirit, Nomadland, and The Courier. And you can check out the reviews of Chris Lloyd and many, many others in the Film Yap website. So go check out thefilmyap.com. Joe writes The Dig, Malcolm X, Marshall, North and South books 1, 2, and 3. Whew. Robert Muggy, filmmaker extraordinaire, writes, let's see, Witness for the Prosecution. That's the Billy Wilder film. Lead Belly, the Gordon Parks film. I own that as well, Robert. Shall We Dance, George Stevens. When Harry Met Sally, that's Rob Reiner. He puts the directors in parentheses. I like that. The Devil is a Woman, of course, that's Joseph von Sternberg. Destry Rides Again, George Marshall. And Deep Blues, Robert Muggy, preparing for an upcoming relaunch of the film. Oh, very good, Robert. Marshall writes The Book of Eli. Mike White writes, watching the movie we are podcasting about on Monday. Nice. that's a hint. Patty writes, Shock, War Gods of the Deep, also called City Under the Sea, The Hobbit, and The Desolation of Smaug. Anthony writes, Ashby. Alan writes, American History X, with Eric Gordon chiming in, rough film. Joni writes, Count of Monte Cristo, with Jim Caviezel and Guy Pearce. Now, this is my buddy Joni Michaels. And I remember reviewing this film on Fox 59 AM way, way back in the day. Mediocre review from yours truly. I forget what What's-His-Face did. Hi, Gretchen Jonathan. Erica writes, Safety Not Guaranteed. Michael writes, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Abdul Shabazz writes, Roots. Did you really, Abdul, or are you just poking the hornet's nest that is my Facebook page? Frankie writes Captain Phillips, Rocket Man, and Bottle Rocket. Adrian writes Evil Under the Sun. Meh. I actually saw Evil Under the Sun in the theater with my dad because he was a fan of Death on the Nile. With this is, of course, the ones with Peter Ustinov as Hercule Poirot, Belgium's finest detective. Britt writes The Dark Knight Rises, Zombieland Double Tap, Miller's Crossing, Bring It On, Ferdinand, Pretty Woman, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Every Secret Thing, and Manhattan Night. Dylan writes Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Deadliest Prey, Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, and Something Indescribable. Uh-oh. It was an AGFA something weird restoration of a movie considered to be the first porn parody, though I think that's a very liberal use of the term. Okay. Thank you, Dylan. Sean writes Judas and the Black Messiah. Kara writes The Truman Show. Andy writes The Maltese Falcon and Kazam. Wow. Ray writes One Night in Miami. Christopher writes Judas and the Black Messiah. Eric writes I'm binging Dexter with Schitt's Creek for a palate cleanser. Tommy writes My Octopus Teacher. Amazing. And Thor chimed in with, I cried, and Tommy admits he cried too. Carrie writes, the Riff Trax version of House on Haunted Hill, the old one with Vincent Price, and then asks, does that count? Yes, it counts. Riff Trax, Mystery Science Theater, Cinematic Titanic, it all counts. Olivia writes, Too Funny to Fail, the best. Robin writes, When Marnie Was There. Frank writes, I recently watched The Handmaiden, an incredibly well-made bit of cinema, but oh, not a story for those with tender sensibilities. Production design is to die for. Larry writes, True Romance, outstanding cast, great script, plausible storyline, a winner in my book, no matter how many times I watch it. I love dark comedies. Jan writes, Judas and the Black Messiah, brilliant, and a complex, weird film called The Accountant Wander. I couldn't finish it, she says. Sharon writes, An Affair to Remember and Shall We Dance, Valentine's movies. Frank also chimes in, I did also do all 10 major Star Wars films. And here are his takeaways. Thank you, Frank. 1, the prequels have an excellent story, odd characters, and occasional dialogue like tin, and least best Williams music. 2, Rogue One is excellent. 3, the original trilogy still works well, although it really shows that the Ewoks were to sell toys, also has the best Williams score. And 4, the sequel trilogy is not as bad as folks make it. Indeed, The Last Jedi is very good. Rise of Skywalker has some implausibilities, but is still decent. Force Awakens score is marvelous. Nancy writes, Casablanca, Never Been Kissed, WandaVersion, not a movie but definitely worth watching, Judas and the Black Messiah, The Age of Innocence, and Strictly Ballroom. Michael writes, watched Night Hunter and Judas and the Black Messiah, Oklahoma, Ace in the Hole, and The Vast of Night. And as a fellow journalist, Michael, I'm always happy when somebody watches Ace in the Hole. Elaine writes, Snowden. Bethany writes, Paddington and Paddington 2. Genuinely delightful. The almost four-year-old may have been the reason for watching, but she's not the only one enjoying them. Ask our buddy Evan. He'll tell you. But yeah, we enjoy those two. And apparently they're making a third. I'll believe it when I see the trailer. Paul writes, finally saw The Red Violin. Magnificent. Nick Rogers writes, Red Dot, Shoot to Kill, Judas and the Black Messiah, The American President, I Care a Lot, and Dave. Don writes, Hickok and Hostels. Kim writes, The Crispus Attucks documentary by Ted Green, and I Am Not Your Negro. Judy writes, The Competition and Seabiscuit. Julia writes, Love in the Afternoon, Love Affair, the 1939 version, To All the Boys, Always and Forever, How to Marry a Millionaire, and Lord of the Flies. Tracy writes, because it brings joy, great joy to my heart, and it's a picture of the Royal Tenenbaums. Kevin writes, The Founder. Nikki writes, Guns Akimbo. It was interesting. And I asked, good interesting or bad interesting? And she said, well, it held my attention for 98 minutes. It was pretty ridiculous, but it starred Daniel Radcliffe and he was using an American accent. So there you go. Linda writes, Leap Year and Wild Mountain Time. Sunday, we saw Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, too. Ross writes, Mayhem, The Lie, Dawn of the Dead, and Closer. Rachel writes, The Fellowship of the Ring, Part 2, The Invisible Man, and The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck. Ron writes, Supernova, typical slow British pacing, but flawless, transparent performances. And Kodachrome, not a particularly original script nor performances. And Gregory is telling me, why don't you knock it off with them negative waves? Thank you, Donald Sutherland. Melissa writes, The Gentleman. Allison writes, The Lovebirds. Mario writes, Goldfingers. Mason writes, The Book of Kells. Also saw Age of Ultron again because Disney served it up after WandaVision. And it was much better than I remembered. Spader is immensely enjoyable. David writes, Dazed and Confused. Jay writes, Life in a Day, 2020. Terry writes, The Spirit of the Beehive, Days of Heaven, Where Danger Lives, Elevator to the Gallows, The Lovers, and The Loveless. Andrea writes, News to the World. Devin writes, Crazy Rich Asians. Joe writes, Dolomite is My Name with Eddie Murphy and The Best of Times with Kurt Russell and Robin Williams. Jim writes, Lawrence of Arabia. Seth writes, We Rewatch Sorry to Bother You. Kathy writes, Mank. Don, our very own Don Hibbishweiler, writes The King's Speech. And finally, Susan writes, Demolition Man, Hot Dogs, Armor Hot Dogs. And there you go, friends. Oh, and if you get a chance, tonight, 8 o'clock, Friday night, Sammy Terry, you go to Sammy Terry's Facebook fan page live, and there'll be a rescreening of The Brain That Wouldn't Die. So there you go, if you're quick on getting this podcast. So there you go. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And actually, before I end the show, I forgot to get to this. IU Cinema, of course, is still streaming. Through February 24th, you can check out Grey Gardens. Through March 3rd, the Buster Keaton film, The General. Through Tuesday, February 23rd, through Friday, February 26th, the 2016 drama Tunnel. Tuesday, February 23rd, A Hard Day at 7 p.m., special virtual event, and Wednesday, February 24th through Wednesday, March 3rd, Gene Dielman, 23, 1080 Bruxelles, Quoile du Commerce. Thursday, February 25th, Kim Sung-hung is it's a Q&A moderation moderated by film critic and IU alums. Tuesday, March 2nd is Woman House, and Wednesday, March 3rd through Wednesday, March 17th, Gangen Hess. So there you go. That's all happening at IU Cinema. Anyway, hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. And hopefully you're checking out some new movies, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we'll go through this next week. So thanks for listening. We'll end this week's show because we replayed my interview with James Keach about the Glenn Campbell documentary. We'll play a little bit of Glenn Campbell doing the title track to the film True Grit, the one he's in, with the great commentary track on it, with his first Glenn Campbell's first entrance, and the Western historian saying, "Yeah, that's a Western haircut." Anyway, take care, and we'll chat. I'll monologue and rattle off titles next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
One day, little girl, the sadness will leave your face as soon as you've won your fight to get just as done. Some days, little girl, you'll wonder what life's about, but others have known battles are won alone. So you look around to find someone who's kind, someone who is fearless like you. The pain of it.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!